is always try and be skeptical. The third take-home message is don't trust the Daily Mail when it tells you that there is a miracle cancer drug right on the horizon. And fourthly, thinking ahead abstractly, the NHS is going through great financial problems. So, I mean, to take this concept abstractly forward is how can we amplify all this that I am going to speak about into a description of clinical want and a description of clinical need? Because always remember that the NHS is free at the point of clinical need. It has never been and never will be free at the point of clinical want. I may want something in healthcare, but I may not need it. And therefore, this is something that you all do have to take away with you all, and you all need to build upon this, because this is very important if the NHS is to live within its means. I realize that this presentation is fraught with danger in the sense that I could be sued for libel, I could be sued for slander, which is why I have been very careful to take the examples from places where I can be able to reference all of them in case any of y'all want to sue me. And I have taken most of my examples from this. Oh, sorry, I'm speaking from here. Right. So y'all should read this document, Heads They Win, Tails We Lose. It was published in February 2012 by the Union of Concerned Scientists. And here's the website. I'm sure that it will be sent to you. It's really a wonderful documentary piece of investigative journalism. Right, moving on. So what are the methods of abuse, right? We have actually spoken all about this today. So just to put it into a sort of an order. So what are the methods of abuse that we can think about? Well, one is obviously corrupting the science. Two is shaping the public perception, or rather misshaping the public perception. Third is restricting agency effectiveness, which means MHRA, NICE, blah, blah, blah. And finally, we have talked about this as well, inappropriately influencing those who matter. I'm going to speak a little bit about corrupting the science, because that's what really affects public health specialists, right? And especially those of us working at the coalface of health services commissioning. And this is what investigative health journalists need to know about. So how can one corrupt the science? You can corrupt the science by terminating its suppression of research. You can do it by intimidating or coercing scientists. You can do it by manipulating study designs and research protocols. You can do it by ghostwriting scientific articles, through publication bias, and through shaping public perceptions. So, let me give you an example of termination and suppression of research. The infamous case of GlaxoSmithKline and Paxson, right? So they commissioned 5 trials from 1998 to 2002. And basically, the trials were commissioned to assess the drug efficacy in addressing pediatric and adolescent depression. They just published one trial, and that published trial had mixed results. What they didn't publish were the 4 other trials which showed negative results, including the finding that the drug raised the risk of suicide. And then when the FDA wanted to get access to the data, GlaxoSmithKline blocked FDA's access to data from the clinical trials, citing confidentiality agreements that GSK scientists had signed. This infamous freedom of information that we were talking about, and how it is abused by the private sector when taking full advantage of it from the NHS. Termination and suppression of research. Here's another example. Don't worry, I've got all these references. So Boots and GlaxoSmithKline can't sue me, right? So Boots commissioned Dr. Benny Dong in the USA to test the effect of Synthroid. Synthroid is a replacement for thyroid hormones, right? and the drug was found to be no more effective than its competitors. But then the company instructed her not to publish the results. And when she refused to do so, they threatened to sue her. After many years, the company relented, but only after having skimmed off a huge amount of profits from selling this worthless drug at inflated prices. Intimidating or coercing scientists. This is rampant in the Western world, right? Coercion comes in many forms, some of which many of us might not even have heard about. Gag orders in research or employment contracts. Scientists threatened the loss of their job, or they've had their research defunded, they've refused promotion or tenure, and have been transferred to non-research positions. And finally, the use of litigation and open research requests to tie up time and resources. To give an example of intimidating or coercing of scientists, the scientist who was overseeing the clinical trial of the HIV drug Remune published an article in JAMA, which concluded that basically the drug was rubbish and was ineffective. The pharmaceutical company then sued the scientist in retaliation. Here's another example. This most of us have read about. You have Avandia in England. It was it's called Rosiglitazone, right? In America, it's called Avandia. And in July 2010, an FDA advisory panel recommended a recall of Avandia used to treat type 2 diabetes and placed severe restrictions on its availability. GlaxoSmithKline, the manufacturer, had in fact long known about its potential side effects, but had chosen to keep quiet about it. In 2000, Dr. John Buse at the University of North Carolina found that Avandia users had a very high risk of heart disease and published his findings. GSK contacted his boss, accused him of lying, and threatened to sue him for a $4 billion drop in the company's stock valuation. So manipulating, next one, moving on. Manipulating study designs and research protocols. So if you look through the literature, you will find that the industry-funded studies are 8 times more likely to find no health effects related to secondhand smoke than non-industry funded studies. And recently, this was in the news, does formaldehyde cause cancer? So this American company which manufactures formaldehyde commissioned its own study then. That study, which found no association between the chemical and cancer, in fact exposed only 1/3 the number of rats to formaldehyde for half as long as the original study. A formaldehyde association quickly publicized the results and argued before the Consumer Product Safety Commission in the USA that they indicated no chronic health effects from exposure to the level of formaldehyde normally encountered in the home. Here's another one. This is another famous one. All of y'all have heard about this, I'm sure. Manipulating study design and research protocols. The infamous case of Rifoxikon, Vioxx, known. The Merck marketing team had developed a strategy called Advantage. And what exactly is this Advantage? Advantage is assessment of differences between Vioxx and naproxen to ascertain gastrointestinal tolerability and effectiveness in order to exaggerate the drug's positive effects to increase the likelihood of FDA approval. So under the Advantage strategy, the Merck scientists manipulated the trial design by comparing the drug to naproxen instead of to a placebo. And they showed that naproxen decreased the risk of heart attack by 80%, disregarding studies that had already found that it had no significant cardiovascular benefits. We all now know that Vioxx has been found to significantly increase cardiovascular risk. And this led to Merck to withdraw the product from the market in 2004. And even today, patients who have taken Vioxx experience complications years after they've stopped taking it. Here's another favorite of mine, ghostwriting scientific articles. One analysis found that articles on 33 of 44 industry-initiated clinical trials exhibited evidence of ghostwriting. Another analysis found ghost authorship of articles on Avandia, Fenfen, menopausal hormonal therapy, Neurontin, Paxil, Tylenol, vagus nerve stimulation, Vioxx, Zoloft, and Zyprexa in medical journals. And this is from the US government POGO in 2011. There were multiple ghostwritten articles on Vioxx, Neurontin, and especially those of us in public health are very familiar with the reports on the Tobacco and Health Research Journal. And there was even a mythical journal which was published on the Australian Journal of Bone and Joint Medicine, which tried to prove that all these new orthopedic stuff coming out was the be-all and end-all of orthopedics. Moving on to publication bias. Publication bias, in 74 trials of antidepressants, all 38 with positive results were published, while 22 of the 36 trials with questionable or negative results were not published. In the case of Risperdal, the results of one trial appeared in 6 publications under different authorship. So it was basically the same paper being recycled over and over again. A study of 691 meta-analyses of antihypertension drugs found that those produced by individuals with ties to drug companies were significantly more likely to report results in the company's favor. Shaping public perceptions, or rather misshaping public perceptions. So how do they do that? It's by downplaying evidence and playing up false uncertainty. It's by vilifying scientists. It's by promoting experts who undermine the scientific consensus. It's hiding behind front groups or capturing organizations. Just 2 days ago, y'all will have all read of the mighty and powerful American Pain Foundation, which is now being forced to dissolve itself because the US Senate has initiated an inquiry into its working as to how it was working in cahoots with the pain manufacturers in order to promote opioid tablets and drugs to the American public. And finally, obviously, we all know about influencing the media. No presentation can present itself, especially from someone who's a public health specialist, without reference to tobacco. And look at this evidence on the tobacco health risks. In a now infamous memorandum, a tobacco executive wrote in 1969 that doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with a body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public. And in response to evidence that cigarette smoke increased the risk of lung cancer, the American cigarette manufacturer R.J. Reynolds argued that statistical studies cannot prove cause and effect relationship between two factors. Mice are not men, and no experimental evidence exists to show that any cigarette smoke constituent is carcinogenic to human lung tissue at the level present in cigarette smoke. And finally, I will leave you with a quote from the immortal bard Shakespeare, from The Merchant of Venice. Right, when the Prince of Morocco opens the gold casket, spurning the silver and lead one, this is what the scroll tells him, and this you must remember, all that glisters is not gold. Often have you heard that told. Many a man his life hath sold, but my outside do behold. Gilded tombs do worms enfold. Had you been as wise as bold, young in limb, in judgment old, your answer had not been in scroll. Fare you well, your suit is cold. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Incidentally, the very interesting the point you were making about journalists should be sceptical. Mostly journalists are sceptical, but it's that trickiness about, so you believe some scientists, but not others, because of course some scientists are the people who give you that stuff. Very interesting. Folks, let's have the next of our speakers. That's Dr. Lucy Reynolds, who's going to talk about the future of the NHS, a small subject.
Lucy, I'm only going to talk about a small bit of it.
Excellent. I'm thinking we'll probably have about 10 minutes for questions.